Hey everyone, welcome to this week's Live Support Ops Hangout. I'm your host, Chase Clemens. This week, Carolyn is still backpacking through Europe. I think she's in some part of Venice now, or at least it looked that way from her Instagram photos. And if you're not following her on Instagram, I would definitely recommend it because her photos are fantastic. Chase Livingston's also out this week. So we've got me and Jeff back like normal. So we'll start with him. Jeff, how are you on this fine just me and you kind of show?
I love it. More Chase time. I'm always in for more Chase time, Chase.
Yeah, you say that, but I really just show up and like ask some questions and let y'all like fight it out. So
yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it works. And we've also got a special guest on this episode to make sure it's not just the Chase and Jeff show. Shervin from over at Partner Hero now. Shervin, thanks for being on the show. And just for people that don't know you, can you kind of intro yourself?
Sure. Thank you. I'm a longtime listener
and first-time caller.
First-time caller, right. I'm Shervin. Twitter is at Calitalia. I run a business called Partner Hero, and I've been involved in support, and whether the technology associated with support or processes or operations for a few years. And I've been a fan of yours and Jeff's. I heard him speak at UserConf years ago, and drank the Kool-Aid. It was like this secret club that was spawned out of UserConf. It's not actually UserConf itself. It's just this like, you know, little thing that's going on, and I'm just happy to ride his coattails, and yours too, Chase.
All right, we have coattails. That's awesome.
Oh, we just need the top hats to go with it.
Yeah. And the monocle, don't forget.
Oh, I've got the monocle.
Why am I not surprised? I just really are. All right, so before we divert anymore, so this week, the whole reason why I asked Shervin to be on the show was because we were looking at a topic that Partner Hero has tackled pretty well. And so this week, we're looking at outsourcing your support team. And when I say outsourcing your support team, I mean, you know, outsourcing that customer component of when people contact you and they need answers. Long story short, you know, when a product is growing rapidly and the team really needs more help on the support side of things, you're kind of limited in choices there. You could go on a hiring spree, but you know, when you do that, your attention's kind of diverted away from growing the company, growing the product, and that kind of thing. So a lot of times, people look toward outsourcing that entire aspect to a dedicated support team. You get all the advantages of a bigger support team without having to go through that whole hiring, scaling, and all that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, is that the right choice? And I think that's one of the things we're gonna hash out, if it's the right choice or not. So let's start with Jeff. Wistia was in a kind of a similar situation before. You know, Wistia is growing as a product. You've got more customers coming in every day, and you started hiring on. And I think you and I had a conversation about where it was tough to keep up. You just had to keep hiring to kind of not even get your head above water, just like tread water and kind of keep things status quo. So what was that process like? What was going through your head when you realized you've got to have more people helping with your customers? You know, kind of walk us through what you're thinking there.
Sure. Well, it started with an oh shit moment, right? You kind of have this, I think that Shervin can probably expand on this, but it's pretty rare that someone at a smallish company has this long-term plan for how they're going to bring on people and when they're going to bring them on, and they're super prepared for when they need to bring on new people. You tend to be in this really tough spot where you don't necessarily have the resources, right, money to bring on a new person. You don't have the onboarding processes in place to make it easy to bring on that new person. You also, you don't really know if the business is going to be around in some cases 6 months. We were not in that case just recently, but you know, years ago, I totally remember what that felt like. We can't bring on a new person because we don't. Not only do we not have the money, but we don't even know if we're going to need them. You know, we need to prove that out first. And so you tend to be kind of stuck in this weird spot. So I guess I started by telling the existing team that it was going to require a lot of extra work for a while, right? You kind of have to level set with them and say, even if we started hiring 10 minutes ago, We're not going to have this problem fixed next week, right? And even if we brought on a brand new person tomorrow, we're not going to have the entirety of this problem fixed in a month or two, right? This stuff takes time. It takes a lot of effort and to be prepared for that. I think that setting those expectations are really important. So probably start with that. I guess the next thing that you've got to do is talk to other people who may have some more insight into the available resources so that you can get a sense of when you should be bringing on a new person. If you have a customer service model in place, that can help you make that decision, right? If you're saying that you want to get back to people quickly and you're not, what are your options? So I guess like just to start, because I'm sure we'll get further into this as we go, that was kind of the starting place for me was like, oh, wow, we're behind. And we've been asking people to do Herculean things already for a while, and it's only going to get worse, right? And all the other teams in the company are kind of like excited about growing, right? And the only downside there is that every time you grow, support grows too, right? And you got to be prepared for that. So success has like some downsides to it, or just costs, I guess. Being prepared when you're not prepared is the best.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking costs and downsides. I mean, it definitely is almost a downside, especially if you're on the support team. You're excited that you've got more customers now because, you know, typically speaking, more emails coming in, tickets coming in, Twitter, whatever coming in, that means your customer base is growing. So the product itself is succeeding, the team itself is succeeding, which means more work for you, right? More of those extra hours worked, more of those just Herculean efforts like you talked about. Sherwin, is that something, so is what Jeff described something you typically hear when people come to you and say, hey, we need some help?
It is. I think so. There are two or three reasons why companies consider outsourcing as an option. And just to sort of take a step back, philosophically, what I share with people is that you should never outsource anything that touches a customer. Okay. Now, having said that, I run an outsourcing company that works in customer support, so I want to try to thread that needle and then be more specific. Mm-hmm. I think we've had situations where people come to us and they say, we're growing, we're expanding, whatever, we just need help, right? Come fix it. And when you dig into what they're doing and how they're doing it, they're in such a state of flux, and you know, it's like, you know, fixing a plane while it's in midair type of scenario, where outsourcing will not necessarily bring the results that they're hoping, right? Just throwing more bodies at it isn't really the best thing to do. And in many cases, they also don't have the luxury of stopping everything to either document or to re-engineer processes or do what they need to do, to the onboarding that Jeff was mentioning earlier. So typically what we see is if someone just says, look, I just want to close my eyes and someone else fix it, the sort of the classic outsourcing, you're mm-hmm. setting yourself up for long-term failure. And there's a real risk to a company that does that, and I'll explain what it is. When you outsource, you just throw it over the wall, just have someone else completely take over a function, it becomes very, very hard later on to either insource or to move it over to a different provider or to chop it up and do strategic sourcing with multiple vendors. So it's a lot like your DNA, or think of an organ that you don't use. After millions of years, the body just sort of thinks, oh, we don't need this anymore. So I think of it a little bit that way. But sort of the good news is that there are a number methodologies for outsourcing, blending the teams, just thinking of them as maybe potentially like remote workers, skills-based, maybe it's tied to a language or after hours or things like that, and also SLAs and things like that. Maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but there are ways to construct the process and the way that they work together, and also the contract, the spirit of the agreement, so that everyone's aligned. Because I think just fundamentally traditional outsourcing, your mess for less, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. Could be a really bad thing for most companies.
And look, your mess for less. That's like, if that's not some outsourcing company's tagline, it really needs to be, because that's fantastic. Yeah, so Jeff, when so we've got the picture kind of set now as far as, you know, what a company looks like and is thinking about when they start looking at outsourcing. Why did Wistia make the choice to kind of not necessarily embrace the temporary pain, but at least put up with the temporary pain with a goal of hiring on and fixing that problem, you know, a couple of months down the road? Why go that route rather than, like Sherman said, just chunk it over the wall?
Well, I don't think that chucking it over the wall was ever going to be acceptable to us. It's just in our DNA to provide support. Not only do we just believe that that's really important, but also it's one of the key things that differentiates us from a bunch of other competitors that would just eat us whole if we didn't. And support can be one of those things that once you lose it, it's gone, right? To Sherwin's point, like once you stop understanding how to do this, it's gone and you can't get it back. And that can be kind of scary. So we didn't want to chuck it over the wall. I think there's a continuum between where we were, which was like, let's like really put shoulders down and be, you know, in the office late and put all this extra work in because we think once new people come on, it'll be easier. There's something between that and let's just give it to this completely outsourced group. We don't even know who's in that group or who's in charge, but at least it gets done. Mm-hmm. Maybe. So it just, the problem disappears. There's a continuum there. And we definitely, I did evaluate options between here and you know, between us doing it and throwing it over the wall. Ultimately, we wanted, one of the things that I think was very key for us was we had the resources and we had the interest in learning how to do hiring really well. If we didn't have those two things, then I think we would have been much more interested in another option, right? Especially if the promise was it would happen faster and it would maybe happen cheaper than hiring internally, that would have been exciting to us if we had been stuck in that problem space. But instead, we looked around and we said, we want to get really good at this hiring stuff. We have a long-term need here, so we're going to need this pretty much forever. And we have resources available, meaning people, time, money, all that stuff to make this happen. So a member of my team, Olivier, just went full time on the hiring stuff. That became his most important thing. He went from being one of our strongest support providers to being someone at more of a meta level who is thinking about who's the next person we're going to bring on and what should their skill set be. Had we not had that option, I think we might have made a different decision.
Yeah, and I think with Basecamp, we were kind of in a similar boat. So when we launched the current version, you know, we were all up in Chicago. I remember that week because it was like almost like a hell week or something like that. We were so excited that people loved the new version and that people were trying it out and they were emailing us and talking with us and that kind of thing. But I distinctly remember, you know, there was a couple of weeks there where at the end of the day, I would have talked to 250 people. Just because, and worked, you know, 12, 14 hours just because that's what it was. And even then, you know, you work all day, there's still emails in the queue, people are still waiting when you go to bed, and they're still there when you get up. And it's just, at that point, it would have been really easy for us to look and go, you know, we're not going to be able to make a dent in this until we get help. And for us, it's kind of like with Wistia, we had resources where we could, you know, reach into other members of the team. So we had programmers and designers that were helping us out because it was just a very short-term thing. You know, we knew the emails were going to die off. We knew that everything was going to become manageable at some point. We just didn't know when. But it was also at that time that we started looking at, you know, if we want to get better, if we want to start making a big dent in the queue, what else can we do? And that's where we started looking at 24/7 support. And to get there, we decided we wanted to get good at hiring for it. So we kind of picked, I hate like stealing Jeff's thunder or anything, but we kind of did the Wistia thing. It was, we looked and said, who's the best at hiring? Who has a real knack for it that can, you know, really pick out people that are going to turn out to be great hires. And we kind of let them go after it. And they did a really great job with it.
One thing I want to add to that, and maybe, you know, Sherwin can tell me if this resonates as true or not, is One thing that I think made us less likely to choose outsourcing as an option, even though, as we talked about, there's a whole continuum and we certainly evaluated that, is that I felt like we already had, to a certain extent, support excellence internally, right? And what we wanted to do was find other people that we could learn how to teach and train them to do that. I think that there are a lot of other organizations out there that see, they don't, it's not that they see it as less valuable, it's not that they see it as not good at it. And they want to be good at it, right? And so their options are try to go out there and hire somebody who is a existing, you know, excellent support lead. And honestly, those people are pretty hard to come by, right? Or they can go to somebody who is an expert in this, right? We happen to have an expert in this sitting in this Google Hangout with us, right? And they can talk to them and say, like, what are my options? Given my situation, what should I do? And I've had lots of conversations with small companies over the years who are saying, like, how did you first come to Wistia? Like, how do I find somebody who can help me start a team? Like, what is that? What's the job listing for that look like? And like anything, it can be really hard to start from zero. So in those cases, you know, finding a partner hero might be really valuable.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you're reading off my list here because that's what I was going to ask him. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I was. So, with both Wistia and Basecamp, we kind of went the hiring route and did it internally, that kind of thing. What happens when somebody like us comes to you and asks, you know, what are the options that we have here?
So, to Jeff's point, I think there are three primary reasons why companies look to outsource. One is, we're just not good at it, or we don't know how to do it. Something along those lines. We've never done it before. It could be any number of that. So it's process excellence, basically understanding, or it's like we've been doing this, but we have never scaled. It's some sort of IP with related to the operations or the technology tied to it, et cetera. So it's some sort of knowledge component. The second is cost. In many cases, people look to outsource to save money, and oftentimes it turns out to be a fallacy. When you're actually all in with all your costs, they end up not getting the returns that they're hoping for. Again, even I just say buyer beware. Just get really specific into the contract and what you're signing up for. The third is a skill set. We need support in Spanish. We need Mandarin. We need God knows what. So it's either a language or a specific skill set that is just not readily available where they have operations. So those are the three primary reasons. And when, you know, the funny story with us is that we respectfully say no to probably 4, 5, or 6 out of 10 opportunities and we explain why. We don't just say no. We really recommend other options to them, and you got, there's so many options. Back to the continuum, you can find on Elance, you can find remote workers, and they're not just Elance. I mean, there are a number of options, right? You can have full-time remote workers. You can have full-time contractors. You can have, sadly, you can also do sort of nameless, faceless body shop type of work. Just chunk up the work differently that way too. You can have your employees that choose to work remotely, right? I mean, again, depending on what you want, you can actually have regional offices. There's so many ways to do this. Even in outsourcing, you can have, you know, big mega companies. You know, I used to work at Accenture as a partner there, and, you know, we worked with the Fortune 500. But that sort of outsourcing doesn't work for a startup. Startups are, by definition, companies that are changing so rapidly that traditional contracts can't keep up with them. A traditional outsourcing contract, basically the outsourcer's motivation is to put lower cost people and lower and lower and lower so they can, you know, maintain their margins. And so the enemy of that is any small change. So if you're outsourcing for Delta Airlines, Delta Airlines innovation is like maybe they change one thing every 3 years. But for at Wistia or at Basecamp, you're pushing code daily, if not weekly, right? Mm-hmm. So think of the pace of communications that you do through Slack, right? And imagine a nasty ass contract, a 7-year agreement that's built not to change, right? these things are just mutually exclusive. So so in most cases, we respectfully tell them, no, maybe there's a different option, and we'll point out some of those one of those other options could be. In other cases, we really try to bring some sobering perspective to the conversation, because everyone talks about the successes of outsourcing. What most people don't talk about are the heartaches, right? They don't talk about the things that, you know, during the sales cycle, man, it was awesome, and this is going to be a home run, and this and that and whatever. And look, it's just like anything else. Operations is messy. Operations is the underbelly, and it's sort of it's like offal, right? If you're really into food, you don't eat a filet. You eat ham hocks, right? So, if there are all the vegetarians who are listening, I apologize. But for me, this is a little bit more of a, like, if you're passionate about this stuff, you know, it's the underbelly. You get deep into it. And sadly, it's not always pretty, but it's the sort of world that the three of us live in, and we enjoy.
This show has got so many great slogans and examples already that it's fantastic. I think, so when I think about turning over that kind of things to an outsourcing company, or even partnering with them, like you mentioned, and having somebody in a very specific niche, like you mentioned, you know, maybe we need somebody that can answer customers in Mandarin or Swahili or something like that. You're not going to find a Jeff that speaks Swahili. Well, I mean, you might, but it's going to be hard to find. So Sherman, when it comes to that, you know, how do you make sure that even though they're your employees, that it's your company that's bringing in and partnering up with this company, how do you balance that with whatever kind of standards of excellence, like Jeff said, that the company has in place already? Like if I go to you and say, hey, I want to have a Jeff that speaks Swahili, how are you going to make sure that they're still your employee, but they meet the standards that Basecamp would want?
Great question. And it starts with where Jeff started the conversation, with hiring. What we do specifically is we spend time seeing how you hire. And it's amazing at how different every company is. It's really quite interesting to me how strategic hiring has become. And there was a time, where sort of the hiring was sort of this boring part of the organization where you'd put people who just enjoyed reading resumes or whatever. Hiring, much like support, is now at the forefront of driving the differentiation of an organization, right? So it starts for us with actually seeing how you do interviews, how you do assessments, how you gauge for cultural fit. Can they learn your tone, your voice? It's not just for technical competence. It's, you know, Wistia has a very interesting and unique voice. Basecamp and Chase have a very unique voice, right? So understanding how you hire for that and then how you train for that, right? So the two components. And then, frankly, we see if we can simulate that. So before we say yes to a customer, we want to see if we can even come close, right? So we'll try to simulate that, and we'll do some test hiring. We'll do mock interviews, and then we'll put some candidates in front of the client, and just to see, it's kind of a calibration, because if we can't do it, there's no reason to get the client to say yes, because 3 months from now, they'll figure it out anyway, right? So our sort of our model is to pull risk forward. Not to sort of look the other way, if you will. But there's a secondary question, which is the balance between the partner hero culture and our values and the fact that they're working as a dedicated member for a different brand. Mm-hmm. And that's a really interesting problem, because on the one hand, we have very specific core values, which are, you know, as one of the founders, we're not a huge organization. It's based on what I've learned and what I believe in and my values and experimentation and honesty and integrity, et cetera, right? And so that's important. But 40, 50 hours a week, their identity is, let's say, Basecamp. They're logging in, signing in, answering questions, participating in chat support, whatever it may be. And if they're too far to just the client, there's a term that we use, it's called going native. And And it sounds like that's not a problem, right? You would think, oh, that's great. Why shouldn't they be native? They should fully have, you know, they should bleed Basecamp, let's say. Mm-hmm. Well, they should. But if they go native, it becomes a management headache for you, because one of the benefits of outsourcing, what you should hope to get, is a scale where, and again, we never recommend 100% outsourcing ever, so we would never even sign up for that. But if you're going to do, let's say, all the experimentation, or if you're going to do level 3, or you're going to do the beta early stage stuff, let's say that's one option, and more of the day-to-day meat and potatoes type of work, you want to outsource that. What you really want to focus on is, as the company is growing, you don't necessarily want to have linear growth to your management team, to all of, you know, your side of this area. You want to turn that pyramid upside down and have an inverted pyramid, right? So that your effect, your leverage is much larger. And if a team member of ours goes native, it's just like you now have 100 direct reports, and that will become a big headache for you. But if they're so far to our side, they're not going to be effective. So the way that we overcome that, I'm sorry, I'm giving a very long-winded answer. The way that we overcome that is being face-to-face with a client. So our team members are, they're, you know, once a quarter, they come out to the Bay Area, they're with the client or wherever our client may happen, their office is, or the client comes down once a quarter, once every 6 months or whatnot, and they spend 2-3 days there with them as well. That synchronization, I mean, hangouts and go to meeting, all that stuff is fantastic. Slack, everyone uses it all the time. But there's nothing like eating with people face to face, just sitting down, watching the work. That's really, really important. So I probably didn't answer the question, but that's my best attempt.
No, I think that's onto something there, because it's one of those. And you and I were chatting before the show about a group out of Nashville. The Dave Ramsey group is great up there, and I learned a lot of stuff from him. And one of the things was, whenever you go to make a new hire, take them out to dinner, because how they interact with the restaurant's wait staff is going to give you a good idea of how they're going to treat your customers. And I think it's the same thing. You know, when you have when you're outsourcing whatever part of this customer experience to somebody else that's remote, they might be, you know, a great face. They might, like, you know, give great email replies. They might, for all intents and purposes, look like somebody that you really want interacting with your customers. But then, like you mentioned, you go down and have dinner with them, and they treat the wait staff like crap, and you get to see kind of their true colors there. Jeff, you know, as Wistia is growing and you're adding to your support team, are you thinking about, you know, does it ever cross your mind to use a company like Partner Hero or CoSupport or any other company out there that's doing kind of that very niche outsourcing for the meat and potatoes kind of stuff?
For the meat and potatoes kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean,
Sure. I mean, one thing that I would probably say is meat and potatoes for us, it's not meat and potatoes for us, but it should be, is, you know, I'm going to go to bed in whatever, 5 hours, and right after that, someone's going to write in.
Yeah.
And they're not going to get any help for hours. And that hasn't shown up on our bottom line yet, but we should be prepared well before it does, right? And
that's a great example right there, because, you know, with Basecamp, we went 24/7 because we wanted to not run into that. We didn't want a customer ever email us and then have to wait for, you know, 2 or 3 hours. So Wistia so far has been all local, no remote or anything like that. So are you going to, when you hire for that, are you going to hire like second and third shift kind of people, or are you going to look for maybe a company that does remote outsourcing kind of?
Well, I have no idea. I really have not a clue. But what I would guess is that we'll evaluate a bunch of opportunities. And I think it might be a great place to work with someone like a Partner Hero to stand that operation up while we fill it in the background, right? So we're learning how to do this, right? But we're not putting like the weight of the world on their shoulders when they start the first day, right? Mm-hmm. And also we're learning how to work with new people all the time, which makes us better at working with a new remote person. I probably didn't say that right, but you know what I mean. If we get good at dealing with the folks that Partner Hero brings in, then we're going to be better at dealing with the first remote person. and they're going to come into a much, one of our biggest concerns is the culture that they come into. Do they come into a culture where they're in an empty Slack room and there's just nobody else there, right? And what problems come up that we haven't even thought about, like, oh, scheduling team meetings. We recently had a teammate who, her husband is working, his hours got shifted, he's working Saturdays now. So she would like to work Saturdays too. And that was like the perfect experimentation place. But now when we're planning meetings, can't be on a Monday because she's out on Mondays, right? Or geez, it would be nice if a couple people would check in during the day on Saturday because, you know, she might need some help. And it would be great to have someone to ping with issues as the day goes on. So you kind of learn how these little cultural nuances affect you in your planning and in the, you know, the habits and the processes that you set up. And it would be great to, you know, it sounds like you get a real head start on it when you work with someone who does this for a living, if you trust them.
Which is key. I mean, that's one of the things that we looked at. So there are 2 or 3 days out of every week where we only have one person on a shift. So like take Sunday, for instance, we have, Sylvia lives in Hong Kong, so she comes in the morning and covers like an Asian shift. Then our EU team comes on, and then our US team comes on. But in all those cases, it's one person who might be by themselves for like 6 hours out of whack. And you do that a couple of days a week, and if you're not careful, then all the culture that you've worked so hard to create Monday through Friday just kind of evaporates, right? They don't have any connection outside of maybe a day or two with the rest of the team. So it's a challenge. That's one of those where if you've got friends or companies or even, you know, partners like Partner Here that can come in and kind of help that, then I think it's a big advantage. So I guess the last thing, go ahead.
I muted myself and then I started talking because I wanted to jump in. I think that I take for granted, and we do as a company, we take for granted the fact that when something happens on the support side or something happens on the app side or whatever, that our support team is there to pick everybody up every time. They've never let the company down, right? Whether the support team was one person or today it's 10 people. When something has happened, they have answered the call every time, right? And they don't do it because we pay them extra to do that, right? We don't, right? They do it because they believe in the culture and in the impact they're having. And like everything else we've been talking about with this, you've got it until it's gone, you know? And how do we know that the people we're setting up, to work when we're not watching, right? Or when we're not there to help support them, how do you still create that that culture, that how do you establish that buy-in such that when something happens, I'm sure that this is happening at Basecamp, something happens at 2 a.m. and Sylvia's up and she's working and she puts in the extra time and you come in and you're like, I don't even know how you did that alone. And, you know, she's like, oh, you know, whatever, I do my thing, you know, I'm badass or whatever she says. But it's because she really believes in what you guys are doing, and to recreate that is not easy.
Yeah, it literally becomes, it was my job. I mean, that's what I was supposed to do, so I did it. So Sherman, how do you make sure, so like the weekend hire that we were talking about, somebody that doesn't interact with the rest of the company a lot because they're working off hours, they're working overnight hours or weekend shifts, that kind of thing. How do you make sure that they still become somewhat native, like you mentioned earlier, that they still fit in even though they're not interacting with a company outside of, you know, maybe 2 days or so?
That's a great point. So, I love the example of in the conversation that you two are having right now. You can't, I still have not figured out how to screen a resume for someone who gives a shit, right? I don't know how to do that, okay? But I know it when I see it, right? And I also know when it's not happening. And in the example that we're now calling it Sylvia, the Sylvia example, when no one's watching, Sylvia is going to do the right thing, right? And for us, the advantage that we have is that we offer a long-term career in not just support, but in content moderation, in operations, and analysis, process engineering. It's sort of a little bit of a broader ecosystem, but because we're a company that's growing very rapidly, we started with six people. We're going to be at 250 within a few months, and we'll probably double again by the following year. So when we hire, people aren't looking to do 6 months or a 1 year stint and move on. There's a career path for them, because support as a vocation, as an area to get good at, and that we're just scratching the surface of it. I'm a student, right? I don't know anything, right? I'm still learning, right? So I think that advantage for us is that when Sylvia is working, she's working side by side other people. Now, they happen to be working on other campaigns, but she actually can lean on other people. It could be a Zendesk question. It could be a Health Scout question. It could be a SnapEngage question, whatever it may be. And she'll say, well, by the way, does anyone else know how to edit the macro and, you know, whatever, right? They do coffee together. We have activities, because it's late, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning. The mind can drift. You could be lonely. There are other things that can happen. It's little things. It's providing night transportation so that there's safety for them. I don't have a secret pill that I can give them to, you know, you'll find the culture. It's touching, listening. It's swag. It's them celebrating the company's milestones. Like when one of our customers, they have a significant milestone, they're proud, because just like you guys, I mean, you know how critical support is to the top line and the bottom line. It's no longer viewed as a cost center, right? So look, it's old fashioned, it's nitty gritty, and it's not rocket science, but it's hard work, and it's also very fulfilling when it works properly.
Yeah. So do you think at the end of the day is, it's not outsourcing in the traditional sense. I think we kind of talked about that continuum, right? That we're not throwing things over the wall kind of thing. But do you think that the outsourcing that we've been talking about, filling in niche roles, you know, weekend support, overnight support, remote support, whatever it is, do you think that kind of outsourcing is just a short-term kind of Band-Aid fix to get through a couple of months? Or do you see yourself working with some companies, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road?
So, great question. So we view ourselves as a niche. We only do dedicated remote teams for growing startups. And I want to explain how small of a niche that is. If you're not a startup, a classic tech startup, which is trying to figure out product market fit, you've raised some money, you've got runway, rapid experimentation, data-driven, but also, you know, that gut feeling and wanting to just dig in deeper, sprints, all those cycles, right? So there's a very classic component there. And then we talk about the fact that they're dedicated. There are companies that provide shared resources. There are companies that bill by the transaction. None of those things, in my humble opinion, truly align the needs of the startup, having raised $4 million and ran a startup before myself, with what the outsourcer is doing. So, and at some point, they should outgrow us. And let's be very clear. Based on your size, or because you're now becoming international and you can actually afford to have an office, let's say, somewhere else, I mean, a proper center of excellence, there's no reason to work with a company like mine, right? Or when you're no longer a startup, you become like a PayPal. PayPal shouldn't be working with a company like mine. They should work with an IBM or an Accenture or, you know, one of these mega companies, right? So, I only know what I know, and it's sort of this, if I think of concentric circles, what I look for are companies that really understand how important it is to listen to their customers for their own product purposes, their own product development, that feedback loop, right? It's not throwing it over the wall. Companies that don't want to get rid of it, it's a blended model, some form of blended delivery, whether it's based on the hours or the type of cues that one takes versus the other, skills, whatever it is. And the third is this alignment over that this is going to be, it's not a 2 month. I want to be very clear. We're not set up to work for 2 months. I mean, the time and energy that it takes to set a unit up, again, just being very transparent, it's not worth doing it for a couple of months. But you could do it for a year, you know, maybe 2 years, something like that, if you wanted to think in terms of a shorter time frame. So that's the way that I think of it. But by no means am I suggesting that this is the only way to solve this problem. There are multiple ways of doing it, and we're just one option.
Yeah, so you found the magic thing that Jeff always talks about where it's like, this might work for you. So Jeff, while we get the expert on and all that, you got any other questions for him? Because that's it. You stole my question earlier, and now I've crossed off all the rest of them. So.
Oh, man. Put me on the spot. This is why you come up with the questions and I just add the idle banter, Chase.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're kind of, you know, our nice little, because Wistia is still, for all intents and purposes, a startup, a younger company, and you're, you know, you're thinking about this as the team is growing. Is there anything that, you know, that you've...
If Shervin and I were to grab a beer, which I would love to do soon, what I would be more apt to ask him, which I won't put, well, maybe he'll have a couple of like high level thoughts on this, but I'm sure he could talk for a while about this next question, is that he just kind of said a minute ago that he and his team are going through the process of hiring hundreds of people. And bring anybody on the show, there's very few people who are going to have the experience of hiring that many support folks. So, you know, you've asked me many times, or other people have asked me many times, Chase, you know, what recommendations do you have when someone's trying to hire somebody for support? And I normally come up with some sort of, you know, short list, right? I go to like a BuzzFeed listicle type style. Oh, here's one, here's two. Yeah, you got to have that, you know, whatever. We're on a chat right now with a guy who has set hiring criteria that has scaled to 200 people. So that's my question, is what is he going to tell us about the magic formula?
Yeah, that's a huge topic. I'll tell you, I'll
Oh man,
he's like, I'm about to release the gold.
I know. This is, we got to love Google Hangouts here, because that was the moment where he was going to give us everything.
He's back.
Never mind. He's back. Okay,
We got him back.
Okay. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah. Go for it.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'll give you, I'll talk a little bit about this, and hopefully I'm going to publish a blog post about it. I am putting a blog post out tomorrow about why most outsourcing fails, FYI. So you'll be able to go to partnerhero.com/blog to see what that is. And it's a very honest assessment of why most of these things end up failing. Let me give you sort of my hack. I've come to believe that most of these things work better by pulling risk forward. And I think of hiring this way. I start off with the fact that I know I'm not a good interviewer. I've actually learned that about myself. And it's a very hard thing to admit. And the moment I understood that, I pulled myself out of the process. I'm much better at designing an assessment. I'm much better at being the third interview. I'm much better at, I mean, so actually really microscopic engineering at steps in the process, right? And I think of it as a process where we have a universal cue, a universal set of criteria that we look for. That's the partner hero piece. And then for each client, there's something very specific we have to do. And what I try to do is de-risk a bad hire so that they flag themselves during the interview process. What I used to do was I have to, you know, we'd come up with these matrices and we'd score candidates and, you know, have other people look at them. And I was just terrible, right? And when we look at our standard deviation and then afterwards we look at our attrition rate 6 months later, et cetera, we'd see that, like, you know, that someone would give someone an 8, the other person would give them a 3. It just didn't, it wasn't working, right? I've flipped the model around so that we simulate the work, and we literally, and this is going to sound harsh, we try to scare the shit out of the candidate. We say, look, do you understand what you're signing up for? Okay. And it could be like a simple thing. We have them watch a YouTube video. Okay. This is someone with no technical background. Okay. They have them watch a YouTube video. Then we give them a wireless router and a printer and a some sort of computer that they don't know the operating system. It'll typically be like a Linux-based or something like that. And we say, set it up. And we're not actually looking if they can set it up. We want to see logically what are they thinking through. That's actually much more important to me than knowing the answer. Because oftentimes with support for a startup, it's not the cookie cutter. I mean, a lot of times it is, and that would be easy. It's, do you know how to think? Do you know how to problem solve, right? So those are the hackish experiments. That's just one example. We try to come up with others. But the other more important one is empathy. And I've come to realize that I'm really bad at measuring for empathy. I only know it if I can have a beer with you or if I can do it face-to-face. When you're hiring 250 people, you have to look at, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 resumes. We can't have dinner with 4,000 people. So we have to find other ways to gauge for empathy. And we have a whole other team that does that. We call it our cultural assessment. And early on, the first team that we set up for a client, they are involved in all the hiring. We are working together, but we have to have them actually sign off on all the initial hires. Once we've fully learned how they do their piece, then we'll scale on their behalf. But this is why I say these things are not a 1 month, 2 month experiment and then everyone goes home. The cost in time and energy is significant. Anyway, that's my just a little bit about sort of how I think about it.
Yeah, see, we need to do like hiring part. What part are we on for like hiring episodes that we've done? Like 6, 7, something like that? We just need him back. And Sherwin, we'll just have you give a masterclass on how to hire 4,000 people without doing dinner.
It's hiring 101. I don't do the hire 201.
Oh, all right. So to keep the episode from going too long, that's what we think about all of this. Let us know what you think, how you do it. You're probably a startup too, so you're probably thinking through all these. Let us know if we missed any questions or anything. supportops.co/contact. That's going to get you over to us. Or you can tweet at us. We're at supportops on I was going to say the Twitter web, but that's completely wrong, and I don't know where that came from. Anyways, that brings us to my favorite part of each and every episode. It's this week's shout-outs. These are the things that are making us happy. So happy we want to shout them out from the rooftops to let you know you should be reading, watching, buying, whatever that product is that we're going to shout out that week. We'll start with Jeff. That way, Sherwin can get the last guest spot. Jeff, what's your shout-out for this week?
I am shouting out an oldie but a goodie blog post by Steph Hay on A List Apart. And the name of the article is Being Real Builds Trust. And there are probably, I don't know, a million articles that are about how being authentic can build trust. This is another of the good ones. Read this one and then read some other ones too, because you really want to feel it, how important that is, especially when you're ever in a situation where you're talking to a customer or a teammate, or anybody else besides just talking to yourself. So if you're working in a company of more than a person and you have customers, you probably should read this article.
So basically everyone that listens to the show, just read it and it'll be fine. It won't take long.
Yes. I mean, my mom listens to the show because it's the only thing that she says that I do that's productive and positive in my life. And she does not currently have any customers or anything. So she can skip the article, but everybody else, get on it.
We need to set her up with some kind of like niche business or something so she can put into practice.
Believe me, Chase, I've been pitching this to her for years and she just won't go for it.
Oh, Sherwin, have you got a shout out for us?
I do. I started to use my Simple account. I set it up when I first got an invite, this was a long time ago. And I should tell you a quick story about it. I read an article when the founder said he was going to launch this. And I, years ago, this is four years ago, I think 5 years ago, I sent him an email or I tweeted at him or something like that. And we just talked briefly. And then I got an invite. And I think I just put $100 in, but I never really used it. Recently, I wanted to try it out again, and I got involved. And I had a support experience that was transformative. And it was so good that that same week I had to deal with Bank of America, and the juxtaposition was one that was like a sledgehammer to my head. And now I've redirected everything to my Simple account, and I'm shedding this legacy product. And I know they've been around for a while. They've just got purchased, and you know, some people may not consider them a startup anymore. But for me, it's a product that's beautiful. It's mobile first. It's just delightful, and the support experience was really beautiful. And I wanted to put a shameless plug in for the folks at Simple.
Awesome. My shout out this week, really simple. I think I've given the shout out a long time ago, but the Dark Sky app for iPhones. I don't think there's an Android one, but I know there's an iPhone one. They just had a really great update that came out, and you know, they've always had a great design. It's always been really easy to use. A lot of times if I'm outside, it gives me, you know, a heads up, hey, it's going to start raining in like 10 minutes or so, which gives me enough time to get in. There's been two really great updates that it kind of blew my mind. The first being that anytime it's going to be a certain temperature, certain weather condition or anything like that, it gives me a warning. So for instance, if it's going to rain and I need to bring like all the plants that I've got set out in the yard up out of the rain or whatever, it lets me know, hey, it's going to rain in 10 minutes. Go do that now. So that was really fantastic. And the other one, a friend of mine has an iPhone 6, and it actually uses the iPhone 6 sensor to somehow figure out to basically mimic a barometer, which is insane. Like to basically start turning your phone into this own nice little like weather collecting tool. So if you don't use it, I definitely recommend it. Their latest update was fantastic. That's the Dark Sky app. We'll have that and all the other show notes up, supportops.co, as soon as I can get them up. And then next week, like we mentioned, Carolyn's still out. Don't have a guest yet for next week. So if you want to be on the show, hit me up. Just supportops.co/contact. And we'll look into it. Other than that, we're going to have a great show for you next week. And until we see you then, have an awesome week.